Welcome to the 8th Annual Homelessness Marathon, a national dialogue on homelessness and poverty in America. The toll-free call-in number for this broadcast is 1-877-NOBODY-8. That's the word nobody, followed by the number 8. Or if you're currently, recently, or about to be homeless, you may also call 1-866-LEFT-OUT. New Haven, Connecticut, famous as the home of Yale University, is perhaps the backstreet girl of American cities. For generations, people born to wealth and power, including President Bush, have passed through it, while people mired in poverty and powerlessness have lived in it. What's up with that? We'll take a hard look at homelessness in New Haven right after this.
This is Hugh Curran, adjunct professor in peace studies at the University of Maine, with a brief review of literature chronicling homelessness around the industrialized world. In the book called Homelessness in United States, Europe, and Russia, the editors Carl Helvey and Wilfred Kunzmann bring together 7 writers in 7 industrialized countries. First of all, in Germany, 80 million people live in a country the size of Montana, with an unemployment rate of 10%, and is rated as among the top 5 economic powers in the West, yet it has a severe homeless population. One of the main reasons for homelessness in Germany is that subsidized housing shrank considerably in the past couple of decades, from nearly 90% of building units to 30%. This placed subsidized housing on the free market and increased costs beyond that which was affordable for low-income people. Reunification accounts for some of this, since nearly 500,000 East Europeans of German origin emigrated into Germany in the 90s. But Germany still provides a major safety net of housing allowances for 3 million residents. Rents are less than one-third of monthly income for most apartment dwellers. In an earlier and more intolerant time in fascist Germany in the 30s, the homeless were perceived as being useless vagrants, and those unable to work were sent to concentration camps. Isolating, sterilizing, and extermination with fascist policies, and this was done by categorizing the homeless as leading unworthy lives. Currently, municipalities in Germany are required to provide sufficient shelter for homeless individuals within city limits. 99% of the German population is insured by private health care plans or by welfare departments. In Russia, with perestroika following the Soviet period, housing shifted from state ownership to private ownership, but owners sold their property, often without considering the effect on their children. There were the notorious Articles 198 and 209 in the Criminal Code of the Russian Federation, which stipulated criminal punishment for vagrancy, and the word tunidyaka, or parasite, was applied to the homeless, and after a court appearance they were sent to a distant detention camp for vagrancy, which was essentially a slave camp. In the course of economic reform, the cost of a dwelling space is constantly soaring. In Russia, there is no government or municipal structure that specializes in helping the homeless. The state policy focuses on punishment. Propiska is a term referred to registering people. Lacking propiska means that one barely exists, and since the homeless lack propiska, they are not given protection under the law. Half the homeless in Russia are victims of crimes such as theft, robbery, assault and battery, cheating, extortion, and rape. The author notes that the group most discriminated against in Russia today are the homeless. There is a book published in the last 10 years called Down and Out in Canada by Thomas O'Reilly Fleming. The author points out that Western society has had a very low tolerance level for the visibly shelterless. O'Reilly Fleming observes that the only proper definition of homelessness should be made by those who are homeless. Those who live the experience are better able to define their state than middle-class researchers, quote-unquote. Several studies indicate that the majority of runaways and street people in prairie cities are Aboriginal, that is, First Nation people, with far more females than males. Poor housing and severely depressed conditions on reserves and in remote communities lead to rural-urban migration in search of jobs, education, and better housing, but leave First Nation people vulnerable to poverty, depression, addiction, and crime. Many of the same strategies are recommended to address both Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal homelessness. However, the literature indicates that the Aboriginal homeless have special needs, including cultural appropriateness, self-determination, and more use of traditional healing techniques. Finally, in Ireland, in a book called The Dublin Slums by Jacinta Prunty, there is a deeply interesting book for those who would like to investigate homelessness in the 19th and early 20th century in Europe, but especially in Ireland. In Dublin, a city at that time of 250,000, About 10,000 were indigent and living in extreme poverty. The Association for the Suppression of Mendicity being another word for homelessness in the early 19th century, came into being in 1817 and blamed widespread vagrancy in Dublin on the disbanding of soldiers and sailors after the end of the Napoleonic Wars. The committee to help the indigent resorted to bringing crowds of the unfortunate mendicants to appeal in person to the hearts and understanding of their more fortunate fellow creatures, in front of the houses of the wealthy, those who had refused to subscribe to a fund to help the indigent. They set up such a shout of execration, quote-unquote, by which means the rich were frightened into liberality, quote-unquote. Nearly £10,000, $1 million in today's money, was collected, which helped to provide shelter and food for the indigent in Dublin for 1 year. Reporting for the Homelessness Marathon, this is Hugh Curran from WERU-FM in Maine.
Hi, everybody. It's me, Nobody, and welcome back to the fourth hour of the 8th Annual Homelessness Marathon, where the numbers to call in are 877-NOBODY-8. That's the word nobody and the number 8. If anybody can call in on that number, and if you're homeless, formerly homeless, or afraid you're about to be homeless, you can also call in at 866-LEFT-OUT. This hour, we are going to discuss homelessness in New Haven. And I am joined here in the Tabernacle of Truth on the street in the back parking lot of Columbus House. I am joined by Allison Cunningham, who is the Executive Director of Columbus House. Allison, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon.
Thank you.
And I am also joined by Benita Grubbs, who is the Director of Christian Community Action, who runs a shelter for families. Welcome, Benita.
Thank you.
And Benita, you're a reverend, are you?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so Reverend Grubbs, should I call you?
That's fine, or Benita.
Okay, Benita, I haven't insulted you by accident then, okay?
No.
Okay, good. All right. We've got a lot of things to talk about in this hour, but let's start with a basic question, which is you each deal with somewhat different populations, and let's talk about who you see. Who is homeless in New Haven? Benita, who are you serving? Who are you seeing? Who are the poor in New Haven?
Well, the folks that we serve at Christian Community Action are families. One of the unique things that we're able to do is to house 17 families at any given point in time in a variety size apartments. And so what we're able to do is to approximate regular normal living even though the family is homeless, and we're particularly pleased because we think it offers the kind of stability that children need to have regardless of what their own housing situation is.
Now, when you say families, you're talking about intact families that have become homeless?
It could be a mother with children, a father with children, two parents with children, we've had grandparents with children. Whatever family configuration comes to us is the one that we are able to take.
Sure, but this flies against the stereotype. I mean, I know for you this is an everyday reality, but for a lot of people out there, it's not. And with the stereotypes, homeless people are all mentally ill or they're all drunk, we think of people who have broken their relationships. But you're seeing people with intact relationships who nonetheless cannot obtain housing.
Yeah, because the situation that we find that families are in is that they are, one, homeless because they don't have enough in the way of resources to be able to afford an apartment, and two, they're not able to find an affordable apartment in New Haven that where they can and their families can live.
It's simple as that. They just don't have the money.
The rental prices are increased. It takes $18 an hour to rent an apartment in the state of Connecticut. Most of the families that we see at Christian Community Action don't make that per hour.
Right. Okay. And this is a problem I can tell you from all around the country. Allison, who are you seeing coming to you at Columbus House? And also you run the emergency shelter as well.
We do, Jeremy, and we see individual adults who come to Columbus House, both men and women. We have two shelters, one that runs seasonally from November to April, and the other is a year-round shelter. In the seasonal shelter, we see only men, and there are 75 people there each night. And here at Columbus House, we see 80, both men and women.
And how would you characterize this population? Would you say that you're seeing people who what is their basic problem? Or is it a variety of problems? How does it stack up to what you're seeing?
Well, it's much the same as Benita sees with her folks, that the rising cost of housing in New Haven is leaving a lot of people out. But in addition, we see quite a few people who are just coming out of prison with no appropriate discharge plan set out for them, who perhaps were homeless when they went into prison and are homeless when they're coming out of prison. We see a lot of people who are dealing with mental health issues, who perhaps have come out of hospitals or who have been living on the streets for a number of years, and our outreach team has been able to engage with them and bring them into the shelter after years of living on the street. So we see a wide variety of complications, if you will.
Okay, and let me ask you, now there's some things that go on in shelters, well, there's actually a lot of things that go on in shelters that the population out there at large does not know about, but let me ask you one thing. For instance, when people are paroled from prison, they're supposed to be paroled to housing, not to a homeless shelter. When people are released from jail, I should say. Well, in some states, that's the case. In any case, you're shaking your heads. Do you see people who are paroled from prison or jail, who get out of jail, who come here and have no other housing?
We do. People may give their last known address in New Haven as their address, but after so much time in prison, that address no longer is available to them. And I would imagine that many of those who are paroled do come straight to Columbus House.
That has happened.
Yeah.
What about you, Benita? Have you seen...
Well, what happens is that the person would come to Columbus House, there would be a reconnection with the children over a period of time, and then we might see them at our shelter.
Okay, so that would be the direct question, would be more for Allison. Here's another thing that I know is happening around the country. People who are in drug treatment, again, I don't know if this happens in New Haven, but I know it happens elsewhere. You know, the 28-day drug treatment programs are kind of out the window. Insurance doesn't pay for it. There are people who go in, they detox them for 4 days, 5 days. Then they continue some kind of maybe 12-step thing, but they're residents, then they're sent over to a shelter. Do you get people who are sent here out of detox?
Of course we do. Perhaps, again, they were homeless when they went in. Maybe they were referred to the detox program from another shelter, from another situation. But going into detox and into treatment, they knew they didn't have a permanent address to return to, so they oftentimes end up at Columbus House. And the challenge with that is that we are a wet shelter. We don't turn people away if they're using. We don't, of course, allow drugs in the shelter. But that does pose problems for folks who are trying to stay clean, because it is a mixed population.
And the last category that I want to ask you about, again, something that goes on all across the country. I don't know if you have it here, but a lot of people would be shocked to know this happens. Is that there are a lot of people who get thrown out of hospitals, who are treated for an illness, and then their insurance gives out, or the hospital decides they want the bed for someone else, and they are discharged from the hospital into a homeless shelter. Does that ever happen here?
Well, it certainly happens to us. I don't know about Benita, but I will say we have worked very hard in the last couple of years to address this with both hospital personnel and with our mental health system in the state. And they are listening. They do understand that it is an inappropriate discharge to release people without a home, and it's particularly inappropriate to release people to Columbus House without any kind of discharge plan. So we're working very hard to help the system, if you will, stop doing that.
Okay.
And what has happened with us is that one of the discharge folks would call us to see if we had placement in our shelter. Sometimes we have had space and sometimes we haven't. But we have gotten phone calls from them because it's a little bit more challenging to discharge a person who has children. And there's a little extra care, I think, that hospitals take to ensure that the person has a place to go. Or the folks would keep the family overnight. Just in the waiting room, somewhere in the hospital space.
Well, I think a lot of people just don't understand the many things that shelters are used for. It's not just for people who are out on the streets or getting indoors. They're often are discharged from someplace, hospital, prison, a detox or something, and they wind up there. I got callers on the line. We got people at the mic, so I do want to go to that. But I got one question before we go to everybody that I want to ask you. Well, I got a lot. Trust me. New Haven is a kind of interesting town because Yale is here. President Bush went to Yale. President Bush's father went to Yale. People of enormous wealth and power have gone. And I'm just wondering, did either one of you ever get a call from one of the presidents Bush or from anybody like that? One of these, Diane Sawyer went to Yale. Mike Nichols, the director, I think, went to Yale. Many very famous people have gone to Yale. Did any of those people ever call you up and said, I remember New Haven, And I was one of the privileged people who was passing through, but I've always had a fondness for New Haven. I hate to think that there are people who are poor in the city where I got my elite education, and I want to give something back to New Haven. Did either of you ever get a call like that?
No. There's a whole lot more that I could say, but simply, no, I've never gotten a call like that.
Something tells me something about your religious conviction is keeping you from fully speaking your mind, but...
Well, I I've been at Christian Community Action for 16 years, and for much of that time, what we did do was provide emergency housing. And in that period of time, we've never gotten such a call. There are some in New Haven who believe that there is a renaissance that is taking place. And in fact, one individual did say to me on an occasion a couple of months ago, was that things are getting better in New Haven, but not for the population of people that you serve. And so in some ways, what you describe about, you know, Yale being here in New Haven and the like, is really very far removed from our reality, at least at Christian Community Action.
Okay, Allison, you ever get one of those calls?
I have not heard from George Bush lately, and I doubt that I will.
And you're from Texas.
Oh, no, buddy. That's hardly fair to bring up at this point.
Well, I'm only saying you're from Texas and you are in New Haven, and if anybody should be getting a call, it should be you.
I would think that that's true, but I've been gone from Texas for so
All
long
right,
that
okay.
I'm no longer considered a favored child of that state, nor did I know George growing up, as many people would like to think I did. Certainly there are people connected with the university who are very generous and supportive of the work that both Benita and I do and have been very concerned about the issues that we face every day in dealing with this particular population and the numerous issues that they face. However, I do think that there is a disparity here, and it's often very challenging to be a part of the community where there is so much wealth and so much poverty. But I think that's true across the country. So whether it's Yale, whether it would be Southern Connecticut or University of New Haven or Albertus Magnus, it still represents a disparity. And whether it's, you know, University of Chicago or University
or
of Texas,
yeah,
it doesn't matter where you are. There is a gap between those who have and those who have not, and it's growing wider and deeper. And the way that our federal government is going, that gap is going to continue to widen and deepen. And as we see more cuts and more slashes to programs that have been helpful in the past, we can only despair that things are not getting better.
Well, I really love talking to you two, but I know there's a long line of people now who want to get in. I got people on the phones, I got people at the mics. So I am going to start taking some calls, and we'll see what other people want to say. So let's start with Ruth from Portland, Oregon. Ruth, are you there?
I certainly am, Mr. Nobody. And what a privilege it is to be on the same program with people who are working so hard and apparently so aware of the needs of the homeless people. I write a column for the Street Roots, which is the homeless paper in Portland, Oregon. And my column is really entitled Hunger in Portland. And I make the point that the working class people who sometimes have working people in the home and an income, and they live from day to day like the old labor song, we go to work to get the cash, to buy the food, to get the strength, to go to work, et cetera, et cetera. And are you still there?
Oh, sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so we're caught in this living hand-to-mouth thing, and the first thing they can cut down on is on food. So when you're hungry, you're only one step away from homeless because you can't cut down on anything else. You've got to pay your light bill. You've got to pay your rent or mortgage or whatever it is. And so my column has been dealing with people who have gone from hungry to homeless. And, you know, this is really a class problem. It's the working class and the haves and the have-nots. And when you talk about a place like New Haven where wealthy people are living there, and in the same town are these homeless, hungry people, it really just tears my little heart out. So the cuts in health, welfare, and education do not meet the needs of people who are not making it. And when they get hungry, it's not long until they're homeless.
Now, I can see Allison and Benita here agreeing. Benita, you want to say?
What I would say is that when we started 38 years ago, that we started as an organization that was helping one family that was homeless. We also provided food for that family and clothing. And as a result of that work and other families that we were able to identify, not only do we operate the 17-apartment family shelter, but we also operate a neighborhood food pantry because we understand that they really do go together, unfortunately, hand in hand. And so what our attempts are to try to deal with the range of things that folks are confronted with on an emergency basis. So we have the food pantry and we have the little clothing corner, and we have the shelter so that we are able to at least provide a range of emergency assistance, because we recognize that it's not just isolated, that persons have a number of problems and the families have a number of problems that we hopefully can address and have been able to address over the years.
Well, that's fantastic work that you're doing, because if you can bridge the gap between hungry before they become homeless, if just get them through a tight period such as a car that broke down or a furnace that doesn't work, and get people have their budget stabilized, if we can prevent just one family from being homeless, you know, your work is certainly wonderful. My sister works with PADS in the city of Chicago, where they provide a meal and a place to sleep to the homeless people in Oak Park, Illinois. Oak Park, Illinois is the home of the Frank Lloyd Wright buildings. Oak Park, Illinois is a very affluent community, but more than 60% of the people who take part in her free meals at the church were born and raised in Oak Park. And so it can happen to any of us.
Mm-hmm. Ruth, I want to thank you very much for the call, and I hope you'll keep listening there on KBOO in Portland.
Okay, could I read a poem before I end?
If it's a quick one, sure.
Okay. Mommy, I'm hungry and I can't sleep. Hush, child, try not to weep. You must sleep now, pleasant dreams. But, Mommy, it's been days, it seems, since we had anything to eat. Hush, child, lay down in the back seat. Maybe tomorrow will be our day. Don't cry, my dear, I'll find a way. Hush, child, try not to sleep. Soon morning birds will begin to peep. Ah, she sleeps now. I can go. It breaks my heart. I love her so. Someone will come along after I part. Someone who cares. Someone who has a heart. I can't go on. No one will help me. I'm a hopeless soul, as you can see. I don't really want to die, but I have nothing else left to try. So take my child. Give her food and care. Send her to school. Buy her clothes and brush her hair. And tell her for me that the world is good, and someday she'll see that Mommy was hungry and couldn't sleep, and she'll remember my love and try not to weep.
Mm-hmm.
I'll close with that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Well, the New Yorker can eat its heart out. We get good poetry here. At the microphone we have...
Paula.
Paula, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon.
Thank
Paula.
You. I have a few things I'd like to say.
Go for it.
And then there's something that I'd like to do for all the homeless, including myself, and those that are not. I am a person who has spent much time in school. Mm-hmm. I taught school for many years, and my money ran out. Money is a very important thing. It's not the root of all evil, because without it, one might not eat.
Right.
It's a very important thing to know that homeless people run the gamut of all society. You can get those who don't want to do anything and those who want to do everything.
Right.
But one runs out of money, and money is the root of getting something done, even on riding a bus. Bus drivers can become very, they just might not be so sweet if you don't have your $1.25.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else, I mean, the restaurant would rather throw food away than to give it to you. Of course, there are food stamps that one can get, and I've been the recipient of some of those just today, and I'm very grateful. I'm not embarrassed. I am not beneath saying, I'm not above saying that I am grateful for my food stamps. Whatever that is, it's a card that I can present at the store. And I don't come from a family of people who rely on food stamps or have ever been homeless. I come from people in the South who had their own land because they had to work triple hard to keep it. Well, I'm landless and homeless and almost foodless, and that's where I am right now. Not proud of it, but I am going to continue. I have the help of this Columbus House. I have been here. I was grateful that I found this place because it kept me from staying outdoors. Mm-hmm. Now, no matter what command of the English language I may have, if I don't have a job, it's worthless. So I am also looking for jobs. And there's one thing that I do that does me a lot of good, and sometimes it does other people some good. So I'm going to do that now, and I hope you'll allow me to finish, and it might do somebody that's listening some good. I'm awfully grateful to be invited to participate in this tonight. Had no idea at the beginning of my life, my adult life, that I would be in something like this, but I find that since this is my life now, I should share it with those who are going to listen to this. Okay. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. Was blind, but now I see. Through many dangers, toils, and snares, I have already come.
I could keep on with this song, but I want to say something, that Jesus is the life of all of us, and if I can present Jesus to people who are homeless, if we plan to get anywhere from where we are now, we're going to have God.
Paula, I want to thank you.
And it will touch all the people that we meet. The people that I've met here are beautiful people. The staff is beautiful. They'll help you. They will do anything they can for you if you are an appreciative person.
Paula,
and will show some God, some faith, and some trust.
Paula,
thank you.
I want to thank you very much. And you have a beautiful voice, and you are very articulate. And I thank you very much for joining us here tonight. All right, we have somebody on the line, Mary from Portland, Oregon. Is Mary there?
Hi, yeah.
Hi, Mary.
Hello, Mr. Nobody.
It's just Nobody. It's not Mr. Nobody. If you want to call me something else, call me Emperor Nobody.
Okay, well, first I wanted to thank you for bringing these issues to the attention of, the world, issues of homelessness and, economic disparity and inequity. One of the things I wanted to bring up first was, I know that sort of the cliche about homelessness is, or the stereotype is, it's largely due to substance abuse, but there's another issue that isn't really talked about, and that's domestic violence.
Sure, that's a very real issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's, in my experience, I've been through domestic violence, and I was homeless after I got out of the relationship, and there are very few resources in a lot of cases for people, women especially, that are in that situation, because it's sort of looked at as, well, you don't have a substance abuse problem, and if you have an education like I do, you're expected to go out in the community and automatically be well connected, and I guess there's this assumption that there's certain advantages that are built into the person's job search that has a degree, but not so at all. When you lose some time from your job, from on your timelines, when you lose time as an employee, you lose time as a competitor in the job market. So you become homeless, and I was homeless for over a year and a half. I dealt with it by house sitting and moving from house to house. It was very difficult. I have a place now, but it's the rent is high here in Portland, and it's a struggle. And there's one other thing I wanted to say is that in Portland, there's a situation that's going on that's very unfair and bordering on being evil. There's builders that are receiving tax credits for apartment buildings that they're building in the inner city that are alleged to meet the needs of income-restricted people. So they set these standards based on, the current housing market and incomes. I don't know where they get these standards based on, some studies they've read. So it tends to be high. The rents are high and the income levels are high. So what's happening is these buildings are sitting empty, lots of them. the homeless situation is getting higher, getting worse in Portland, and then there's these empty places. I think it's really criminal because the builders get tax credits for building those buildings.
Wow. Well, you've raised a lot of points, and let me ask Benita, first of all. Benita, what have you seen in terms of domestic violence? What impact has that had?
Well, it certainly is an issue in New Haven, as it is in other places, and there's an organization called Domestic Violence Services in New Haven that I think does a very good job of attempting to deal with the population of people in a manner that I think has compassion and also tries to meet the needs that are there. In our particular situation, we certainly get referrals, but because we have apartment-style housing, what we want to do is to make sure that the individual is safe as she can possibly be without having the perpetrator around in the environment or for the children to be unsafe. So it is an issue. There are not enough resources. One of the things that has been tried over the last couple of years has been connecting with people of faith so that they can actually be engaged in providing support to individuals who are victims of domestic violence.
See, I think, Mary, you're helping us to get at something here, which is really important. Yes, there are people who are substance abusers on the street. Again, I want to remind people there used to be flop houses for people like that. It isn't automatic that if you're using alcohol or something, you have to be on the street. Most alcoholics are not on the street.
Right. Actually, I know a lot of very successful people that are the substance abusers.
Sure. Look at Robert Downey Jr. How many times has he been in a rehab? You never heard about him being on the streets. Sure, there are mentally ill people on the streets. There's a lot of them in houses, too, and I might even suggest there's some of them in politics, but I won't. But never mind. And, sure, but there are a lot of other things going on. There's domestic violence. There's people who just lose their jobs, don't have enough money. The rent-to-pay ratio isn't good for them. There's every kind of different circumstance that can result in homelessness, but mainly because the harder it gets to have housing, the easier it is to be homeless. It's that simple, and all kinds of people are finding it too easy. So I thank you for bringing these pieces together. Is there anything else you want to tell us about this?
Well, yeah. Thanks for bringing this to the media, because typically I think the mainstream corporate media is, presenting it and framing it in a way that is very derogatory. And so, yeah, of course. I mean, the whole presentation is slanted, so I appreciate you talking to homeless people and letting them say what their story is instead of, like I think one of your earlier callers said, instead of having a white politician describe what a homeless person's situation is or what their needs are.
Uh-huh, right, exactly.
More empowering to give the people that are actually having an experience, their own voice.
Well, I don't even look at it that I'm giving them a voice. I look at it, I'm giving them a microphone. They've already got voices. And
yeah.
I just think it's time that their voices were heard finally. Because, when I turn on the evening news, I'm one of these people who shouts at the TV when the news is on, and there are people I can't even listen to. So if you want to talk about where you can go to hear a lot of nonsense that can really get you irritated, I tell you, I hear that coming into my living room. Thank God I've got one all the time.
Uh-huh.
So when I do this show, I certainly hear a lot more sense than I often hear on the evening news. I'm sorry to say.
Yeah.
That's the word.
I'll just say this one thing. I'll leave you with this.
Thank you.
If you want to know the truth about politics or the economic or the social situation in North America, don't get it from corporate media. The affiliates, CNN, the big names. Don't rely on them for your information. It's all propaganda.
Thank you very much, Mary. Thank you for the call.
Thank you,
Allison. Let me ask you a question. Because we've never been outside of a shelter like this before. We've been in a lot of places with this broadcast, but not outside of a. We were outside of a day shelter last year, which is a very different kind of thing. But there's a lot of regimentation in a shelter, and Frank Morales, who was on in the previous hour, I've forgotten exactly the phrase he used. I know he has used the phrase low-intensity incarceration about these shelters. Let me ask you, first of all, are shelters the answer?
To what?
To the problem of homelessness.
Well, it depends. Right now, I would say, yeah, because it's all we've got.
Yeah.
And if shelters weren't here, we'd have 100 people at least at this address, who would be at risk of endangering their lives, because many of them would be on the streets and would not be able to find a place to stay. And in this climate, they'd be dead. So for that reason, yeah, we've got to keep the shelters. But is it the end and the solution ultimately? Absolutely not. If we haven't figured out by now that the solution to homelessness is housing, then we don't get it. But I think here in Connecticut, we've been working really hard to convince legislators and city officials that what we need is to create housing that has support services with it, along with more affordable housing. That is the solution, and it's long in coming.
Benita, what would you say to that? Are shelters the answer?
I would concur with Allison. The truth of the matter is that providing a space for a family is just a temporary solution to the problem. The longer-term problem is really to provide affordable housing, a meaningful job that pays a living wage, some opportunity for children to get a decent education, and the range of other kinds of things that families naturally and normally have. The individuals that we see on a daily basis are really individuals who are homeless for a variety of reasons, and I consider homelessness a temporary solution. I would rather not have the number of folks who come into our shelter or call us seeking emergency assistance like that. I would rather have individuals in their own homes, living their own lives, doing their own things, raising their own children. So the solution is really going upstream to provide housing for the housing that that is no longer around in New Haven and no longer around in many cases across the country.
So, okay, hey, folks, here we have, I am talking to two people who run shelters. And I am sure there's, well, we've heard some tonight, people who bless you every day for doing that, and you've saved, I'm sure, a lot of lives. But nonetheless, neither of you thinks that's the answer. Allison, what do you say, though, to people who say, look, I mean, this is an important issue. I hate to bring it up, but look, people say they're too regimented, they're too police-like, the shelters. I think you run a good shelter. It is a shelter. I'm not a big fan of the shelter system. I want housing, too. But I think you run a good shelter. I think you run a better shelter than many, many shelters across the country. I think you do it. I know you're a caring and compassionate person, so I don't want this to come across as criticism of Columbus House. But nonetheless, people line up, people have hours, people have rules. What do you say about that?
It's for safety. If we didn't have rules and regulations, it would be chaos. And we're not going to... The reason we run a good shelter is because we keep the peace and we make sure that people are safe and that they're not coming in and using drugs and they're not coming in and acting out and they're not coming in and raising hell. And the only way we can do that is by enforcing rules. And yeah, you know, it's hard. It sucks. People don't want to do it. But I think they all appreciate the fact that they know they're going to be safe when they come in the shelter. And that's the bottom line for me.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Benita, how about you? Is it less regimented at a family shelter, or do you have a lot of rules
well? There are a variety of ways in which organizations do indeed provide shelter for families that are homeless. Some of them have dormitory-style sheltering. Some have alcoves in a section of a shelter. There are a variety of ways in which people provide that kind of service. From the time that Christian Community Action started providing sheltering, we were actually committed to apartment-style sheltering. So the regimentation is really around meeting with the case manager on a weekly basis and making sure that the children are in school and attending tenants' meetings. But otherwise, they are really free to come and go. They have their own keys to the apartments, and they're able to cook and to do the range of things that normal families would do. So it's a little bit less regimented, but part of it also is because we have the ability to house larger-sized families, and so our physical layout dictates a little bit more flexibility.
And you don't have the kind of turnover, I'm sure, that they get here. I mean, because you're not dealing with transient. Families are more stable.
Yeah, families are in residence for 60 days, but in our case, and I'm sure it's the case with Columbus House, that 60 days is not long enough, and so we have actually been housing individuals for up to 100 days consecutively, because the reason why they would move out is that they would have another place to go to, and that becomes tougher and tougher as the years have progressed. And so to accommodate the family, to support them as they deal with the struggle of trying to find a permanent place to live, we will indeed keep the individual family sheltered for a longer period of time than what our normal length of stay has been.
At the microphone we have, what's your name?
Hi, Stacy.
Stacy, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon. Stacy, what's on your mind tonight?
Actually, I've been through this system. I'm in my own apartment now. As a matter of fact, today I had my inspection, and it'll be 2 years.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And just wanted to speak on it a little bit. I don't really know what I want to say. I just know from my experience there are, you know, many reasons why people become homeless. It can be just that they're living paycheck to paycheck and they lose their job. They become physically unable to work or maintain the kind of work that they had and keep up with their expenses. I've heard a lot of the men in the shelter saying because they're paying child support that it doesn't leave them with much money to provide what they need for themselves, and they're taking care of their children first. I know that another aspect of it and a big part of it, and the reason why people do speak on it so much, is the problems with mental illness and substance abuse. I was fortunate enough to go to a conference, the national conference in 2001, on that issue, the homelessness due to dual diagnosis. And I was just told recently by the director here that about 25% of the people that come through Columbus House, just this particular shelter, have a mental illness issue, and out of that, 60% of them also have a substance abuse issue. And it's very true. Many people with these particular issues are able to sustain themselves and be functional in society, but the people that wind up here obviously are not capable of doing that, or else they wouldn't wind up in this situation. And it seems as though society stigmatizes it so much, and there are so many cutbacks within this system, and there aren't enough resources as it is to provide the people in this particular situation with what they need. Mm-hmm. And all I hear is how they're cutting things back, even prescription drugs. People with mental illness, just to get them to stay on prescription drugs sometimes is a big enough problem. And then compound that with the fact that they can't afford them, or, you know, unless they're in a dire situation, they're not going to, you know, be able to have them provided to them. It's to the point where you really have to have nothing in order to get anything. And that's why people wind up so low, because during the interim, people are trying to juggle that problem, and then it gets to the point where they just can't no longer do that.
Mm-hmm. Let me tell you something, Stacy. I personally, I am more likely to believe in flying saucers than I am to believe that mental illness and drug abuse cause homelessness. That's not to say there aren't people with those issues in the system.
No, that's exactly what I'm not saying. It does cause homelessness.
No, they're vulnerable.
What causes
homelessness is vulnerability, and that, of course, if you have any of these things, you're vulnerable. But I would like to ask Allison, are those figures, is that what you would say is right? What percentage of the people who come through here have these issues, would you say?
She's right. Stacy's right. The percentage of people with mental illness runs about 25 to 30%. The percentage of people with a substance abuse problem, is a little bit higher. It runs about 45 to 50%. And then there is that population that has an overlap in both of those issues. And that's probably another 30%.
Okay. And do you see less of that, Benita, in a family shelter?
Probably.
Yeah, I think that's indeed right. There used to be, I'd say about 5 or 6 years ago, much more that we saw with individuals who were diagnosed as mentally ill or individuals who had substance abuse problems. But the overwhelming majority of the folks that we see come to our shelter because they have no money and no housing. Now, there may be other issues that have to do with histories in the family, you know, other kinds of challenges that individuals have faced that we try to help them with during the time that they're in the shelter. But overwhelmingly, it is no place to live and not enough money.
Yeah, I mean, there was a case, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago, there was a DuPont heir who had an estate and grounds, and the U.S. Olympic wrestling team was training. He provided a facility on his grounds for them, and he was crazy as a loon, and he was schizophrenic. I don't remember the diagnosis. I may have the details wrong, but he murdered one of the Olympic wrestlers in a delusional state. Mm-hmm. So it was a famous case. Well, this guy was so crazy, he was murdering somebody in a delusional state, But he wasn't homeless. He had a huge estate. So what made him different from the mentally ill people who were on the streets? He had money. So, you know, when I look at that, I think it's the money issue that's the causal issue. That's not to take away from what you're saying, but I personally want to get that across.
Absolutely. But my point being, though, that that particular sect is so stigmatized that people can understand more readily other issues.
Right.
Before that they will take this into account. And that's why I think there's such a significant population with that particular problem.
All right. Well, Stacy, I want to thank you so much for participating in the marathon and coming to the mic.
Thank you.
Those numbers to call in here on the Homelessness Marathon are 877-NOBODY-8. Or if you're homeless, formerly homeless, or afraid you're about to be homeless, you can also call 866-LEFT-OUT. And we have Amy from Torrington, Connecticut on the line. Amy, are you there?
Hi.
Welcome to the Homelessness Marathon.
Oh, thank you. I didn't really have a subject that I was going to completely talk on, but having been homeless myself, and I'm also now working at a homeless shelter out here in Torrington Chapter of Fish. I mean, I've been watching it for years. My first bout of homelessness started 20 years ago, you know, with children. And back then, it was people kind of turned their head. You know, I lived in the woods at one point in time with one child and, you know, pregnant with another one for 9 months before I could get out of it. And it was the fact of not having the money, not knowing where to go, you know. It was hard. It was very hard. And I'm not going to say that, you know, as years passed, that there wasn't a drug and alcohol basis to it. But, you know, it took a long time to get out of that whole circle, you know, because it keeps going around. And, I mean, I look at it today that, you know, one small change in my life, I lose my job or, you know, something winds up, you know, costing me a lot more, either medical-wise or anything like that, it really tips the scales. You know, I could be homeless again with my children.
Well, how secure do you feel in your housing?
I feel I'm secure enough, but like I said, if I wind up having, let's say I lose my job, you know, within 6 months, if I don't find another one that's going to supplement this as well, I'm going to have problems. You know, that's kind of the way it goes, you know, and that's what I'm seeing with people who wind up coming in.
Well, so, Amy, if I understand you correctly here, you are saying the divide between housed and homeless isn't really that sharp a divide. You can cross that line pretty quickly.
Very quickly. Very quickly. Had a call in the other day, people that were looking for a shelter to go to, husband and wife with two kids, and they had owned their own home and everything else. They were doing just fine. She wound up getting cancer and had to leave work, and they slowly but surely lost everything. And, I mean, it was like the course of maybe a year. They wound up losing their home. They wound up losing everything they had, and they literally had nowhere to go. You know, they were on an end of the state that really didn't have much for families, or, you know, the places that did have for families was all full. And they wound up picking up and actually going out to Hartford, from what I know. But, I mean, that's how quick it goes. It goes quick. And as you're looking for any type of help with that, it's hard to get. You know, you have to be all the way down in the dumps, literally, to get the help. You know, I mean, we have a 90-day stay here. And even at that point, by the time you're finally at the point where you are getting the help that you need and you are getting on your feet, you have to leave.
Well, you know, you're touching again. I'm so glad you're bringing this up because so many points have come up. We never have time to cover everything, and I'm glad when points come up we didn't allot an hour or two. Medical bills are now the second leading cause of bankruptcy in the United States. A lot of people are homeless because they lost everything because of an illness because we don't have national health insurance. Allison, have you ever had anybody in your shelter who became homeless through that route?
Oh, sure. I just talked to a woman yesterday who was saying that that experience was what she went through, that a family member got sick and the hospital bills just mounted up and her house was taken from her. And the next thing, you know, here she is. So it's true. You know, we say, oh, we're all just one paycheck away from being homeless, and I don't think that we really know what that means until we hear this kind of experience.
Okay. Amy, I want to thank you very much for the call. Thank
you
for bringing all those points up. Okay, we have somebody at the mic. Who's that at the mic?
Hi, I'm Antoinette.
Antoinette, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon. What's on your mind?
Thank you. I thank the Clemens House for having me here, and I there's a lot of issues, there's a lot of problems. I think Allison, because she's real, and I'm not trying to put the shelter down, nothing like that, but you have to hear our plight. I've been homeless for 2 years because of a fire, and a landlord renting me a condemned building. I thank God that I'm here today. I'm not screwing out on drugs anymore. I found an apartment today, and the grace of God, the landlord says, well, do you have good credit? I said, well, it's not that bad. He says, were you ever in jail? I said, yes, I was. I was in jail for murder. And I felt bad about that, but at least I was honest. And through the grace of my God, I really think I'm going to get that apartment this week. And just hear our plight and just know that anybody could be homeless. And I just thank God each and every day for my mom. I have a better relationship with them. And even though I have my problems with the people in the shelter, it's better than being out in the street, because I have slept out in the street in the greens. And I have did things in my life that I'm not proud of. But I thank God I have 3 beautiful kids today. I'm engaged to get married, and I just thank God for the shelter. I'm not trying to put you all down, but you need to hear, everybody need to hear our plight and just know that just like I might have a house today, you might not have one tomorrow. And it's all over the world. There's not enough income with SSI or whatever to make our amends meet. Nobody wants to get high. Nobody wants to be screwing out on drugs. Nobody wants to be out there in the street prostituting or whatever. We want to take care of our kids. And just to know, when one door closes, another one opens. And I just want to thank you, Allison and Mr. Bill Johnson, for helping me out, because I know what you did for me, and Gary Barnett. Thank you. God bless you.
Thank you very much, Antoinette. And I must say, Allison, that was helpful to me, because up until now, I thought you were a fantasy. But, you know, she says you're a reality, so I'm taking her word for it.
Just a figment of their imagination.
Maybe so. Okay, I'm going to take one more call, and then I got a question for Benita. But Shelley from Lafayette, Colorado, welcome to the Homelessness Marathon.
Hi.
Hi, Shelley.
I was just wondering, for the people who are formerly homeless, you know how a lot of people are one paycheck away from homelessness themselves. Well, what happened to bring people out of homelessness? Like, what was the door that opened? You know what I mean? Was it someone you met?
Okay, let's let Allison and Benita respond to that. You've seen a lot of people get out of homelessness. Start with you, Allison. What has gotten them out?
We sometimes refer to it as the light that went on. That suddenly that's the aha, that people are able to actually either stay off drugs or stay in treatment if that's what they need to do, or stay in work or do those kinds of things. That's one reality that we see, and people say that. And they said, it took me a couple of times, but I got it, and now I'm doing really well, and that's great to see. We see a lot of people that use the shelter over and over for a good number of years, and for those folks, it's that seventh time that they try it that they finally get it. So was it a door that opened? Was it a different face at the end of the treatment program? Was it the fact that they got a job? Was it the person that said, yeah, you know, I'm going to take a risk on you, even though you've got a history of a felony on your record or bad credit, I'm going to rent you this apartment? It's different for every single person, and everybody has their own story, but it's that one thing that tipped the scale that means that they're going to make it. It's remarkable just to hear all the different stories that there are.
Benita, what would you answer to that?
I would describe it generally as making a connection. Sometimes it's the connection that the person makes with a case manager, with their own situation, with a landlord, with a person who can give them a job. It's really about making the connection, and as Allison said, I think something clicking for them in a way that it hadn't before. And I think I would say one other thing, and that is that I've come to understand that it's not up to me to give up on individuals. It's not up to any of us to give up on the individuals who come here, because we never know when one encounter with an individual is going to make the difference. And you know, I can't tell when an individual comes into the shelter whether or not the person is going to do well or not. It's not up to me to judge. My job is to really provide, and the staff to provide the kind of support so that things can click.
All right. Well, Shelley, I want to thank you very much for the call. We're going to try and get some more people in here. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the answers.
Thank you. Okay, at the mic we have...
Monty.
What's your name?
Monty.
Monty. What's on your mind, Monty?
I believe I can answer that question the young lady had posed, because I have been homeless.
Okay.
I've slept on the green. I've slept in people's basements and in abandoned cars. You know, the change comes within self. You know, if you don't really want to change as an individual, then you will stay the same. I mean, the bottom line is you have to want to change.
Well, what about Monty, if you were the same jerk you always were, but somebody offered you a high-paying job? Would that help?
I mean, a high-paying job or not, if you're staying the same, you know, whether you got a high-paying job or not, you'll still end up homeless because you don't know what to do with the money.
I'm not buying this. Honest to God, Monty, I love it. It all sounds good. I personally don't really entirely believe it. If you were a homeless person and you were an utter jerk and you were terrible and you won $10 million in the lottery, wouldn't you have a house?
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, yeah, I would have a house. But at the same time, if I stay this utterly jerk, again, a rich man can be poor just as a poor man can be rich.
Well, that's a little deep. That's actually a little too deep for me. I'm just a radio host.
Well, understand this. Just as well as a rich man can get broke,
yeah,
and be homeless, and a person winning $10 million,
yeah,
can get a house.
Right.
That person, if he stays a jerk, he could be just like that rich man that lost his house.
Yeah, I understand that. But look, you know, we've had some wealthy people who are less than savory. You know, I mentioned Robert Downey Jr., name Kobe Bryant leaps to mind, maybe, mm-hmm. or O.J. Simpson. Well, he was innocent, in quotes.
Yeah.
All right, that's my opinion, too. But never mind. I mean, you know, O.J. Simpson isn't homeless. I mean, these people have, shall we say, little character flaws. So why are we making this whole thing that, oh, well, you got to have the light going. Maybe if someone just gave you a wad of cash, you'd be out of this mess.
That's also true. If somebody gave you a wad of cash, you would be out of a mess. But if you're a jerk and you spend a wad of cash,
Okay, I'm not arguing that point. I agree with you. You know, you can be, if you're a complete idiot and you blow all your fooling his money or soon parted, I hear you. I just don't want to make it all about, oh, I need personal salvation. Believe me, there's a lot of people I'd like to see get some personal salvation who've got a lot of money and they ain't getting the salvation. So, you know.
Listen, look at the guy who won the $5 million in the lotto some years ago. From my understanding, he's $5 million broke.
Maybe so.
I mean, so what's the difference between him and one of these guys in a homeless shelter? What's the difference?
Yeah.
There's no difference at all.
Well, Monty, I have to move along, but I want to thank you. Even if I am having some fun and talking to you about
this.
Hey,
I'm having fun, man.
Okay, good. But listen, I want to thank you, and I want to congratulate you on getting your life together and being an inspiration.
I got 3 years sober.
Good for you. God bless you, and thank you. I wanted to ask Benita a question before we left this topic, because we're moving into the God category.
Must be a faith question.
Had to be one. Look, Benita, we just went through a presidential campaign where the values question, the only values question that was presented religiously, and darn if the Democrats weren't so lame, I'm ashamed of my own party, but the only values question was gay marriage. Is this the whole sum total of Christian values? I mean, from where you're sitting, I mean, doesn't your faith lead you anyplace else?
My faith leads me to justice. Mm-hmm. I was listening to a brief interview between Jerry Falwell and Jim Wallace a couple of days ago,
right.
And the conversation between the two of them was rather scintillating. But Jerry Falwell was talking about acts of charity. Jim Wallace was talking about acts of justice. I like the idea of doing justice and walking humbly with God and being merciful. And that seems to me to be what providing sheltering for folks who are homeless is all about.
Well, we're not going to top that. That's a good place to leave this on. We're almost out of time. I want to tell people that I am not going to be the host for the next 3 hours of the marathon, and then I'll come back and wear myself out. In the next hour, Pat LaMarche, who was the Green Party candidate for vice president, will be our guest host. But in the meantime, Allison Cunningham of Columbus House and Benita Grubbs, a reverend of Christian Community Action. I want to thank you both very, very much for being my co-hosts on this hour of the marathon.
Thank you.
All right, and we're going to go to break, and then we're going to come back, and Pat LaMarche will be the host here on the marathon.
You are listening to the 8th Annual Homelessness Marathon, produced in conjunction with WPKN Community Radio in Bridgeport, Connecticut. The opinions expressed on this broadcast are not necessarily those of the producing or participating organizations or of the originating or affiliated radio stations. To view the webcast of this broadcast, order tapes, or contact Nobody after the show, go to www.homelessnessmarathon.org. It's fun.